Unless you live in a warm place, the arrival of Christmas means you can no longer kid yourself. Winter has come. Each year, that is particularly hard to accept for commentator Julie Zickefoos.
The sky couldn't be heavier, lower, grayer, weepier. It's 38, going for a low in the 20s. It's the dead of winter now. And I still have blooming flowers in baskets and containers on the front porch. Geraniums, lobelias, blue marguerite, plectranthus that when you brush its leaves smells like a lime margarita. Sure, they're a bit brown, nipped around the edges, but the geraniums are blooming, shocking pink, red, magenta, like there's no tomorrow. And for them, there isn't, unless I keep bringing them inside. I pile them up in the foyer, and they weep leaves and dirt and petals that track all over the house. They block the closet doors. I can't keep them inside, but I can't leave them out to freeze. So I shuttle them in at night and out during the day, groaning with the effort. I've brought them this far. How can I sentence them to death? But there's a string of nights in the 20s coming up, teens even, and sooner or later I'll have to say goodbye to summer for good. There's something about looking out the kitchen window on blooming baskets of flowers that feels increasingly wrong. These bright jolts of color are somehow unseemly when everything else around them is dead. And it's not just the plants that are dying. 3 times in my life I've found a big praying mantis staggering weakly around my garden after the first light frost, and I've taken her, it's invariably a female, inside. I set her up on a big potted plant where she sits regally all day, a weird alien pet, watching snowflakes drift down on the roses outside the window where she once lived. I do this knowing it's wrong, but unable to leave her to die outside. I feed her crickets and mealworms, spray the leaves down with water, watch as she grabs and stabs, delicately dines, bends to drink droplets from the leaves, grooms her forearms and feet like a little otherworldly cat. She turns her head to watch me when I walk into the room, holds out her spiked forelimbs to ask if she might ride on my arm to another plant to sit in a spot of winter sun. This goes on until late January, February even. I get entirely too attached. And then, like Goldie Hawn in Death Becomes Her, she begins to decay. First, it's an antenna, then a foot, then a lower leg simply falling off. And then she loses her balance and falls and busts off a forearm. And I see why mantids are meant to die with the first hard frost, and it's brought home to me why I should never have brought her inside. So it goes with the geraniums. I have to let them die. Tomorrow, or maybe the next day, with a light snowfall for a funeral shroud. Oh, the intractable human heart. It does this every year.
It's commentator Julie Zickefoos, and by the time you hear this, you can rest assured that she will have consigned her geraniums to the compost pile. She lives and writes in Whipple, Ohio. And we leave you this hour with a reading recommendation from our series You Must Read This. Rabi Alamaddin is a Lebanese-American writer. The novelist Amy Tan has described him as someone who reads the most international fiction of anyone I know. And his recommendation comes from Portugal.
I love eccentric writers whose neuroses make me seem well-adjusted in comparison. No writer, not one, was more neurotic than Fernando Pessoa. The Book of Disquiet by Fernando Pessoa. It's one of life's great miracles. Even though every edition of the book lists Pessoa as the author, he didn't write it. One of his creations did. Pessoa invented numerous alter egos. Arguably, the four greatest poets in the Portuguese language were all Fernando Pessoa using different names. He didn't stop there. Pessoa invented short story writers, translators, philosophers, an astrologer, a baron who committed suicide, and a hunchbacked, lovelorn woman by the name of Maria José. More than 72 creations by some accounts. The poets themselves may have been Pessoa's best creation, but his greatest literary achievement is the Book of Disquiet. What makes this book, this fictional diary, transcendent is that it deals with the eternal quests, the meaning of life, of death, and the disquiet of the soul. It quenches the thirsty mind and floods the arid heart. When I first encountered disquiet, I felt like laundry. The book dunked me in pristine water, battered and wrung me, and hung me out to dry in sunshine, rejuvenated me. The Book of Disquiet manuscript, as well as most of Pessoa's work, was found in a trunk after his death. He hardly published anything while alive. Pessoa, the man, was a bookkeeper, a loner. He had no friends, no loves, no family. He lived most of his life in a single room in Lisbon, his literary alter egos and their writing his only companions. He died in obscurity in 1935. Pessoa might have died a recluse, but if you read his book, he'll be your good friend. He certainly is mine.
That's writer Rabi Alamadin, author of The Hakawati. He was recommending The Book of Disquiet by Fernando Pessoa. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. A moment ago, we heard about families who are underwater on their mortgages and about the question of whether homeowners should simply walk away. Well, now, the opportunity created by the housing crisis for first-time homebuyers. The National Association of Realtors has found that nearly half of those who bought a house last year were jumping into the market for the first time. Prices are down and interest rates remain low. And then there's the $8,000 federal tax credit for first-time buyers. NPR's Jeff Brady met two of them on a tour of one Denver neighborhood.
Brian Chalmers is just back from one of the most important meetings of his life.
Hi, how are you?
All right, I'm Jeff.
Brian.
He just signed the closing papers on a 1950s single-level brick ranch in Denver's North Park Hill neighborhood.
Welcome to Brian's new house.
That's his real estate agent, Ann Connolly. Getting to this point was not easy. Chalmers earns about $25,000 a year and saved up that much for a down payment.
It's been a five-year struggle living in very inexpensive apartments, cooking rice every day. I've gone without a cell phone for 5 years.
His new house is in pretty rough shape, but at $125,000, he can finally afford to make the jump into home ownership.
There was a time back in 2004, 2005, when people were purchasing this same kind of home for, you know, the high 100s, low 200s.
Ann Connolly says Chalmers got this house under a short sale agreement. The lenders accepted about $75,000 less for the property than they'd loaned on it to the previous owner. There are other examples of good deals like this in the neighborhood, too. Just a few blocks away, Courtney Gross and Rebecca Wolf are preparing to spend a first Christmas in their new house.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, Jeff?
Courtney?
Yeah.
I'm Jeff.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Come on in.
They're in their late 20s, and both are social workers. They paid just over $182,000 for the house last spring. That's $28,000 less than it sold for in 2004. And, Wolf says, that was before the house was completely remodeled from the basement to a new roof.
Because the market dropped, everything kind of went under, we were able to get a house that, you know, a few years ago we wouldn't have been able to afford.
There was just one thing missing, says Gross. The windows needed updating. That's where the $8,000 federal tax credit for first-time buyers came in handy.
So then we turned around and used that tax credit to put in new windows, but then we also get a tax credit on new windows.
Their real estate agent, Vicky Porter, says a few years back, foreclosures really pushed down prices in neighborhoods like this. Now, she says, lenders are more interested in working out short sale deals before a foreclosure is underway.
So there's still some great opportunities for any buyer, but especially first-time homebuyers with the tax credit.
Back over at Brian Chalmers' house, he can't wait to begin work.
Ripping up these carpets and throwing them in the trash is the top of the list. They're filthy. They're orange.
Even his agent has the remodeling bug. She wants to see the oak floors under that carpet.
Hey, what's under this blue carpet here in the hall? Did you look in?
Chalmers reaches down, grabs a corner, and rips.
We can start the demo right now.
Chalmers plans to work on his new house over the next month, then move in around February 1st. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
Time for a Science Friday flashback. Wondering if it's safe to have poinsettias and mistletoe in the house for the holidays? Here's Edward P. Krenzelok, director of the Pittsburgh Poison Center and a professor of pharmacy and pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh. So that whole thing about poinsettia being poisonous is a myth?
It really is. You know, there was a Swiss physician from the Middle Ages by the name of Paracelsus who said everything is poisonous, and what differentiates a poison from a remedy is the dose, and that's sort of it with poinsettia. If you eat enough, you'll become ill, but the typical poinsettia exposures that we encounter, whether they're, you know, being contacted by the sap from a bract or the leaf or ingesting some, really don't amount to anything. I always choose to call them sort of a glass of milk for the child, a tincture of reassurance for the parent.
And mistletoe and holly and all that stuff, mythology?
Well, you know, mistletoe has been called the kiss of death, but there's a European variety and an American variety, and the American variety has very little toxicity associated with it when it's ingested in small amounts. I think the biggest hazard with mistletoe would be when you buy mistletoe and they have plastic berries attached to it. If the berries happen to fall on the floor, I think they pose more of a choking hazard for a child. And then holly berries are very attractive, and they're red and enticing to a small child. But if you ingest enough of them, yes, you may have some stomach discomfort and so on. But typically kids ingest small amounts, and it doesn't present a problem.
So all that advice to give anybody, kids, the Ipecac and make them throw it all up is bad advice.
Well, it really is. And, you know, we abandoned Ipecac and formally in 1997. And so while it makes you vomit, there's no evidence out there that shows that it changes the outcome of a patient. So even if someone ingests a large amount of some medication, we never use Ipecac anymore because it just doesn't change patient outcome.
So the remedy is worse than the illness in this case.
Well, I think you hit it right on the nose.
Wow. Is today or this holiday season, is it a particularly busy day at a poison control center?
Well, not any more so than any other time. I think children are attracted to a lot of the nuisances that may be under a Christmas tree. So there may be choking hazards from small parts that are from toys. It may be a situation where there's some perfume or cologne or some hand lotion or something that someone received that a child might accidentally get in their eyes, on their skin, perhaps ingest a little bit. So I think the type of exposure that we see on days like today after Christmas and through the holiday season are a bit different, but the volume isn't any higher, actually.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Dr. Edward Krenzelok, director of the Pittsburgh Poison Center. So is there a more dangerous or something that we could classify as the most dangerous thing about the holidays?
Well, you know, I think it's alcohol, and that would pertain to both adults and children, but children are particularly vulnerable because if, let's say there's a party and mom and dad go to bed, don't clean up the beverage glasses after the party's over, the children are up early in the morning before mom and dad, and they consume some of these diluted alcoholic beverages that are sweet, taste good, it could actually cause alcohol poisoning in a small child. And children are vulnerable, too, because it can lower their blood sugar quite precipitously. So I think For me, I think the one with the greatest potential out there to cause harm is alcohol.
Huh? You know, I never think about that.
We're present as well.
Yeah.
During this time of the year,
especially if you're staying over at relatives' houses and you're not used to the place, or they're not used to you being there.
That's right. And I have a little bit of word of advice for people when they're going to Grandma and Grandpa's house or somewhere else. And it may seem kind of silly. And if you have a 2-year-old, an 18-month-old, a 3-year-old, and they're the sort of the poison-prone ones, crawl through the house on your hands and knees, because then you'll be at the level of the small ones, and you can see what they can see, whether it be some medications that are low or some cleaning products that are low or something else that might be hazardous to a child.
Mm-hmm. What about, the kids now have the toys are there. It's the day of the holiday after Christmas, and kids are playing with their toys. Can we be relatively sure that the lead paint is gone, that the Chinese-imported lead or paint that's bad for them is not going to be on those toys?
Well, that's really an unknown. But I think in large part, there's a lot of embellishment about that. Yes, if they swallow something, it's hazardous, but most of the paint that's on toys is in a good state. It's not something that a child is likely to have a problem with unless they're chewing on it. So if they just happen to have it on their hands, playing with it, even hand-to-mouth behavior of products that contain lead that are in good shape where they're already covered over with paint or something, I don't see those as a general hazard. But if they're ingesting things like that, and especially chronically, over time, and maybe even some heirloom ornaments from the Christmas tree that are peeling and have lead paint on, and children are attracted to the little bright specks of paint that might be on the rug and putting them in their mouth. That does pose somewhat of a hazard, but again, I think to a large extent it's over-embellished.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Two film fantasies open today, Sherlock Holmes and The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. Our critic, Bob Mondello, says one has mystery, the other has magic, and both have Jude Law.
Jude Law is just the start of the parallels. Both also feature midgets, 19th-century atmospherics, near-identical establishing shots of St. Paul's Cathedral. Probably means I shouldn't have seen them on the same day, but it's not as if anyone would ever confuse them. Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus is elegant and weird, whereas Sherlock Holmes is rock'em sock'em and loud.
Holmes, where are you going?
Guy Ritchie, who usually directs sense-assaulting gangster flicks, tackles a detective franchise known for brain-teasing clues by turning Sherlock Holmes into an action hero and his story into a cross between The Da Vinci Code and Fight Club, complete with both the former's pentagrams and the latter's extreme boxing matches. Didn't know Sherlock Holmes could box? Well, as played by Robert Downey Jr., he's a regular prize fighter, mostly so that when a rival pugilist spits at him, the director can freeze the action and let his super sleuth analyze how to pulverize the guy.
First, distract target. Then block his blind jab. Counter with cross to left cheek. Dazed, he'll attempt wild haymaker. Weaken right jaw. In summary, ears ringing, jaw fractured, 3 ribs cracked, 4 broken, diaphragm hemorrhaging. Physical recovery, 6 weeks. Full psychological recovery, 6 months. Capacity to spit it back of head, neutralized.
Then the director shows it in real time. Also featured are a gorgeous girl, an indecipherable but presumably nefarious plot, a villain who comes back from the dead, a chase up a still-under-construction tower bridge, and Jude Law's amusingly annoyed Dr. Watson.
I never complain. When do I complain about you practicing the violin at 3 a.m, or your mess? Your general lack of hygiene, or the fact that you steal my clothes.
Call it a pumped-up, anachronistically modern Sherlock Holmes for the attention deficit crowd. The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, on the other hand, is deliberately old-fashioned, the story of an aging storyteller magician who has a magic mirror you can pop through to another world. Dr. Parnassus, played by Christopher Plummer, also has a pact with the devil, played by Tom Waits, a pact that is, shall we say, alarming?
Yeah, you shouldn't drink. Tell me what you want.
The devil's already won the magician's daughter in a previous bet, but he offers Dr. Parnassus a chance to save her using his imaginarium. Whoever gets the first 5 souls to cross over wins.
First of 5? Huh? No tricks? No cheating?
No cheating.
I'd say yes. Deal.
It's a high-stakes deal, with the magician's daughter in the balance, played out in a lot of trips through that looking glass to a fabulously digitized fantasy world, also played out through one very deft bit of movie magic involving the late Heath Ledger. Ledger plays a con man who leads folks into the mirror and the Imaginarium's dreamscape. The character is pretty central, and when Ledger died before he could shoot his fantasy sequences, director Terry Gilliam had to scramble to preserve his final performance. The scenes on the reality side of the mirror had been completed, so now when Ledger pops into the mirror, out the other side in an identical white suit pops Jude Law, or Colin Farrell, or Johnny Depp. Of course, in a film as hyper-inventive as this one, a shape-shifting character counts as almost unremarkable. Terry Gilliam's mind is among the true wonders of independent cinema, and if his movies are sometimes muddled, they just as often smack of genius. Though this one is crammed a little too full of invention for its own good, it leans towards the genius side, like those wonderful stop-action graphics that Gilliam used to do for Monty Python. The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus is a blend of the surreal and the romantic, 19th century Victoriana and 20th century slapstick. Visually, it's pretty wondrous. Imaginatively, it is delightfully deranged. And really, isn't that what you'd want in an Imaginarium? I'm Bob Mondello.